So one of the things that we like to do here that I absolutely actually love Bob for doing this is this thing we call Questions of Faith, where we take a few minutes to really acknowledge and wrestle with some of the things that come up for us. Perhaps something came up during your week or during the sermon. If you look at those blue prayer cards, there's actually a little section on the back of that if you don't have a prayer request you'd like to lift up, where if you could actually write a question. And so after Pastor Bob and I, we were able to connect this week to talk about the worship service last week, even though I wasn't able to be here. He and I had a really lengthy discussion on it. I went over and kind of talked to him with it, and I really was grateful to be a part of a community who took seriously what happened last week in Charlottesville and really talked a lot about that in our worship service. There were a couple of things that he said that in our conversation we felt like we want to maybe elaborate just a little bit more on. Specifically, there was this part where Pastor Bob mentioned that he felt as though he, as a straight white Christian, felt this particular kind of moral obligation to speak out against racism and what happened last week. And so I'm going to talk a little bit more about why that is particularly the case and why we are in theological agreement in that sense. And so if we can go to the first slide. And so I'm going to talk about this briefly because I think this is kind of, at least this first slide at least, kind of something we should already kind of know. Why should Christians work against the injustice of racism? Fundamentally, I believe that as Christians, we are called to do what I call living backwards. And by that I mean we live with the end in mind. We as Christians know what the beloved community is and ought be. The space in which people of all faith backgrounds, people of all religious backgrounds, people of all sexual orientations, just all people are living in this idea of what Isaiah calls the beloved community, right? This space where people are surrounded and lifted up in God's love. And we have this glimpse of that when we have worship on Sunday in these kind of communities. We know what it's like to be in a space where people actually gather in love. And because we have this taste of it, we are called to live in such a way we're pulling other people towards this kind of loving community. We're pulling society towards the end because we know what the end is going to be. So in that way, I think the best way for me to understand is living backwards. So living with the end in mind. We pull this from the life of Jesus. We see this in the way in which Jesus interacted with those who surrounded him. More particularly, I think we look at this passage that I believe kind of encapsulates Jesus' understanding of his ministry while on earth that we find in Luke 4, 18 and 19, where he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So there's this way in which Jesus understood his particular mission while on earth is to be with those who were suffering, those who were oppressed, those who are on the margins, right? As he himself was a marginalized person. He knew that that's where ministry needed to take place. And this activism that we see in the life of Christ, I believe, is rooted in his understanding of what it means, what he calls the greatest commandment, to live in love, loving God, loving yourself, and then loving your neighbor as you love yourself. So this notion of love created this importance within Jesus to foster the kind of community that we know we want to have, this beloved community. If we can go to the next slide, please. So, now that we know why it's important for Christians to focus on or to be against the racial injustice, why is it particularly important for white Christians? Now, there is an unfortunate legacy, but particularly within America, of white Christians and white Christian theology being complicit at minimum, but also at times pro and promoting slavery and racial injustice. And I think it's important for us to recognize that that's a part of the legacy of the Christianity in this country, and that many of the hate groups that gathered understand themselves to be Christian. They understand themselves to be operating out of a Christian framework. So they've taken the gospel and they've used different parts of it to justify their kind of hateful rhetoric, right? And so what I believe is that as people in a position of privilege, it's our moral responsibility to speak up and speak out for those who have been silenced and those that have been othered. Otherwise, we can be complicit in their suffering. And so by this, I mean, it's important for men to speak up for women, right? Because we live in a society that privileges maleness. So it's important for men to speak up for women because we have that particular kind of space and that kind of authority. Straight people, must speak for those in the GLBTQ community, right? Because we are in a space where things are set up for us to be normalized. So it's important for us straight folks to speak up and to work against the oppressive structures for our gay, lesbian, transsexual brothers and sisters. And in this sense, this is where white people must also speak up for people of color, those who are oppressed. I have a picture of a book right there written by a man by the name of Thornton Stringfellow. This isn't just some run-of-the-mill guy. This person has his doctorate in divinity that he got from Yale Divinity School, so very well-educated. The title of this book, if you can't see it, it says Scriptural and Statistical Views in Favor of Slavery, right? And so you must understand that this was a very deeply theological issue, that people were writing these kinds of treaties to argue for the enslavement of black and brown people. He argued that because there are verses in the Bible that do not prohibit slavery, because of those verses in the Bible who do not prohibit slavery, therefore American slavery can be justified. He looked particularly at verses in Leviticus, particularly at verses in Ephesians and verses in Romans, actually, that Paul writes. I know this should sound somewhat familiar, right? Verses in Leviticus, verses in Ephesians, the kinds of verses people use today to use to oppress our GLBTQ brothers and sisters. Same kinds of things that people are pulling these little verses to say, well, you know, the Bible doesn't say slavery is bad, so therefore slavery can't be good. He was looking at more of these particular kinds of proof texting, these particular kinds of passages, rather than, and I will tell you, as a theologian, you can make an argument strictly using the Bible to say to the degree that slavery is okay. You can't say slavery to black people is okay, but you can say slavery is okay. But if you look at the text and the spirit of the text, what's the overarching arc of the text? The space where God is a God of love and a God of liberation from oppression, where God is anti-oppressive. If you understand the arc of the text, the spirit of what Paul is talking about, you know that Paul will be against any form of human oppression that we understand it today. Beyond slavery, we move to this space where we talk about the civil rights movement. And I think this is kind of where we find ourselves today. I have a little clip up here, a point I want to make. I want to highlight. Many of you are familiar with Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham, right? The letter of Birmingham Jail. What many people don't know is that letter was actually addressed to 8 clergymen, right? 8 clergy were actively against what Martin Luther King was doing in his fight for civil rights for black people, for people of color, right? He was responding to the way in which these 8 clergy didn't want him to come to Birmingham because they said he was an outside agitator. And obviously all these 8 clergy were white. And so there again, we see this way in which white Christians at times have been complicit in the suffering of others. King goes on to write in that letter, he says that the greatest stumbling block for black civil rights in this country wasn't the Klan or other racist groups, but it was white moderates who were more devoted to their understanding of and preservation of law and order than to Christian justice. And what he's saying is that when you're in a space of privilege, sometimes you can get to a place where you're more concerned about your own particular well-being and your own worldview and preserving that, as opposed to stepping out and recognizing that faith requires risk. And that in order for someone to actually, the marginalized persons, to receive justice, that means you are going to have to take a risk, right? And you're going to have to stand up against those systems that perhaps give you an undue advantage, an undue privilege in and of itself. If we go to the next slide. So now we know that there's this legacy within a Christian tradition that enables certain groups of people to be complicit in the suffering of others. And I would say, again, this happens with straight people when you're talking about issues of sexuality. Right now we're talking about race, but you could do the same thing about gender as well. So now I want to just end on saying a little bit about what we all can do. What could you do? What can we do to really be actively anti-racist? The first thing you can do, and it's something I've learned most explicitly, I would say, in my marriage, is to listen more and talk less. Listen more and talk less. But I think this is important. I say in my marriage because as a man, I know I have this particular kind of way in which I see the world through my own masculine lens, right? And so there were times, especially early on in my marriage, where my wife would say, at one time in particular, where she was having a really tough time at work. And honestly, in hindsight, looking at it, I didn't believe her. I believed that she was making more of the situation than actually what was happening. because I was interpreting through my own lens as a man. I'm like, well, maybe they don't. Maybe these men are talking to you like this. They don't mean it like that, right? And I had to learn that, you know, I need to actually believe her experience, because the way she experiences the world is different from the way I experience the world. It's just quantitatively different because I'm not a woman. Likewise, when a person of color is telling you something that's their own particular experience of the world, maybe it's very different from yours. But that doesn't mean that it's untrue. It doesn't mean it's untrue. And so it's important for you in a position of privilege to just listen and believe. And if you find yourself, well, I don't understand that your experience, what you're talking about, is different than mine, ask yourself, why might their experience be different than yours? Rather than saying, well, this is how I experience it, and let's maybe get into debate about why my experience is more right than yours, right? So listen more and talk less. The second thing is read and educate yourself about kind of the history of what's happened in this country and how we've got to this point. Now, I am talking about this for about 7 minutes right now. I teach a class literally on this subject where it's 14 weeks for two classes a week for an hour and a half, right? So clearly there's a lot we can learn about this. But one thing I would encourage you to do is to just read some stuff. Read Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham. If you have questions, you can Google it. It's free. It's right online. It's an amazing, amazing letter. If you have any questions about it, feel free to just email me. We could have a study about it. Other things you could read: James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, Michelle Alexander's New Jim Crow. Maybe if you aren't into reading, you could watch a movie, both on Netflix and Hulu. Is 13th, a movie that just recently came out that kind of talks about the legacy of slavery and mass incarceration, but also is an excellent documentary called I Am Not Your Negro, which kind of builds upon James Baldwin's text. And I would highly, highly recommend either one of those if you're more into watching movies, perhaps, over than reading. And lastly, I want to leave with this idea of recognizing that I think one of the worst things you can do is to say, I don't really see color. I know that maybe that's what many of us were taught, that was a good thing to say, that we don't see color, because you say that means you're not prejudiced. But the challenge with that is saying you don't see color, it's like acknowledging that you don't see me as how the rest of the world sees me, and my embodiment, right? Because it's impossible for us to live in a world and not see color, because our world is structured around issues of color and issues of gender, right? And so what you can do is say, I see you as who you are, and I actually love you because of this, right? I understand that your experience is different than mine, and it allows me to be in relationship and conversation with you, fully recognizing that our experience of the world is going to be different. And that's a good thing, because I can learn from you, and you can learn from me. Ultimately, all of these things that we're supposed to do come from this space of love, this space we're called to love our neighbor. And this isn't easy. This is definitely challenging. And I know this isn't an easy thing to talk about in the beginning of or before we have the sermon. But I know it's really, really, really important. And so I would encourage you to maybe do some of these things. I would encourage you to talk to your children about this, especially if you have your high. That seems to be an age where we see the kind of beliefs where perhaps they were taught by their parents to treat everybody equal, but things get shifted around at that age. So I'd encourage you to be mindful of the ways in which we have to seek to love each other and allow this love to transcend the kind of racial boundaries that can be created in our society. Thank you.